So welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. For everybody who I haven't met yet, I look forward to meeting you. And for everyone who I have met, thank you so much for coming. So we're approaching Rosh Hashanah, and there's so many things to talk about. But something that will really be taking up a majority of our time on Rosh Hashanah, I know right now it seems like the meals must be the only thing that we're going to be doing, but really there is another part. We will be in shul for a large part of the day. And obviously something we're thinking a lot about is our tefillah and how we're going to approach our tefillah. So if you look at the models that we're given on Rosh Hashanah for tefillah, we of course have Chana that we read about in the first day of Haftorah. And when we think of Chana, we think of her praying for children and pleading with God and just all great things, right? Chana, great tefillah, God answered, seems like she was successful. But what if I were to tell you that I don't think that Chana's tefillah was that nice? I think Chana was quite a mechatzav. Mm-hmm. I think she was demanding. I think that she was even, shall I say, chutzpahdik to Hashem. And I'm wondering why we have Chana as this model of tefillah. How can I prove it to you? It seems audacious for me to come and call Chana chutzpahdik when she's the one who made it into the Haftorah and I'm sitting here in Chicago. So how can I prove it to you? So if we look at the first few sources on our sheet, if you look at source number one, the Gemara Masechet Brachot says, V'amar Rav Eliezer, Chana hiticha dvarim klape mala. Chana threw her words at Shemayim. Shenemar v'titpalal al Hashem. Melamid shehiticha dvarim klape mala. It doesn't say that Chana davened to Hashem. It says she davened on Hashem, that she threw her words at Shemayim. I picture like arrows aimed at Hashem, that Chana is as if screaming, throwing her words at Shemayim. So this doesn't sound too great, but okay. Maybe that was just the style of her tefillah. We know people that get really passionate, and passionate doesn't have to be a bad thing. So let's continue. Further on in Masechet Brachot, it says, Imra o tereh. So in the Pasuk, Chana says to Hashem, Imra o tereh, that if you see that it should be good for me, it should be good, and if you see not, please give me children. V'amar Rabbi Eliezer, Amra Chana lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Chana said to Hashem, Ribono shel Olam, Imra'o, if you see, mutav, it should be good. So if you think I'm worthy, great, then please give me children. V'imlav, and if not, tereh, Hashem, you wait and see. Eilech v'esater b'fnei Elkana ba'ali. I'm going to go and seclude myself with another man so that Elkana should see. V'kevan d'mistatrana misakoli meso. Sorry, Mashkuli Mesota, they will give me the waters of the Isha Sota, meaning she is going to seclude herself with another man. She's going to get Elkanah to accuse her, which he will bring her to the Beis HaMegdash. She will be a Sota. She will have to drink the waters that an Isha Sota has to drink. V'iyata usa toratcha plaster, shene'emar v'nakita v'nizra zera. And what's this going to help? It says in the Torah that if someone is truly a sota, someone clearly was with another man, and they are rightfully accused, their stomach will explode, whatever the exact punishment means. But if they were wrongly accused, then they get blessed with children. So Chana said, you thought you meant one thing by that, Hashem. I see that as a loophole, that I'm going to get myself accused of being an Isha Sota, so you will have to give me children. Now, this is definitely chutzpahdik to say to Hashem, like, I found your loophole. Definitely not something that each and every one of us would come into shul and say, you know, Hashem, really what you intended to be as something, I think I deserve that, so you should give it to me, or I'm going to do it anyways. Definitely on the chutzpahdik track. Again, in Masechet Brachot, in source 3, Amar Rabbi Eliezer, Miyom Shabara HaKadosh Baruch Hu et Olamo. Lo haya adam shekaru laHaKadosh Baruch Hu tzvakot. So we're used to the name that's used often in Tanakh, to us at least, it seems, Hashem Tzvakot. It seems like a grand name of Hashem. Like we're used to many names of Hashem, and one of them is Hashem Tzvakot. But Chana is actually the first person that called Hashem by this name. So what does Tzvakot mean? Achabata Chana Tzvakot. So Chana was the first one to call him that. Amra Chana Lefnei Akash Baruch Hu. Chana said before Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam, Mikol Tzva'ei Tzvakot Shebarata Bolamecha Kasha Be'inecha Shetitein Li Ben Echad. Hashem, you created Tzvakot, like Tzava is an army. And Chana saying, Hashem, you created armies and armies worth of people. It's hard for you to give me one son? You were able to do so much. How is it possible that I don't even deserve this one son? Mashal l'mah davar doma. What is this comparable to? L'melech basar v'adam, to a human king, shasa suda l'avadav, that made a feast for his servants. Ba'ani achad ve'omer al hapetach, and one poor person comes and stands in the doorway. Amar lahem, he says to them, Tnuli prusa achad, please just give me one slice of bread. Ve'lo hishkichulav, and they don't give him, they don't pay any attention to him. Dachak v'nechnasi tal hamelech, he pushes down the door and enters straight to the king. Amar lo, Adoni hamelech, my master, the king, Mikol suda shasita kasha be'necha litin li prusa achad. You made this huge feast. It's beautiful. There's tons of meat and bread and everything that you have for your servants, and you can't give me one slice of bread? This is definitely comparable to, I know, whenever you make a simcha in Brooklyn, there's always people that come around asking for money, and they come straight in and they say, who's the Baal Simcha? They know who to ask. They say, you just spent however many thousands of dollars on flowers and food. You can give me something. Whether or not they're doing the right thing, it's a smart tactic. They know who spent a lot of money here. So in the same way, Chana is saying, you did all of this, Hashem. You have an entire world. You have filled up the world with armies and armies. And she's reminding him that through calling him Hashem Tzvakot. You can give me one child. So I think we've pretty much seen that the way Chana approached Hashem is definitely not what I see as a model of tefillah. That you're going to come to Hashem and say, Hashem, I deserve this, and you're not giving it to me. What, Hashem, it's too hard for you to give it to me? Or, you know what, Hashem, if you don't give it to me, I'm going to trick my way into getting it. This definitely doesn't seem like the straightforward idea that we think of when we think of a day of awe coming before Hashem out of fear and with just such trepidation. We definitely don't think of coming before Hashem and saying, if you don't give me what I think you should give me, then I'm going to go out of my way to get it. Yes.
How is that different than Rivka saying, Hagali banim ve'im ayin meitha nochi? That's pretty dramatic.
I think that what Rachel is saying when she said, Hagali banim, I think she was saying that to Yaakov. That I think it was, obviously she intended for Hashem to hear her anguish, but I think it's a different approach to go to a human being and say, like, I'm going to die without this. What should I do? I think is different from coming to Hashem and saying, what, Hashem, it's too hard for you to give it to me. Like, I think it crosses over from, like, there's a point of begging that you're still, at least in my mind, there's a point in begging where you're still putting yourself in the lower position. To me, it seems almost like Chana is equaling herself or trying to put herself in a challenging position to Hashem. Where I think saying, like, I really feel I need this or I'm going to die, as Rachel said, I feel like that's still coming from a place of begging, of you're still the one in charge, but I don't know what to do. To me, it just sounds a little more defeatist than Chana seems very, very confident that she's going to get what she wants. So how do we reconcile this with the idea that we know that we learn so much of Hilchot Tefillah from Chana, that we really do? We read about her on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. She must be a role model, or else she wouldn't be there. So I would like to say that rather than being a complete mechutzav, someone I would definitely not want in my classroom, I would say that Chana is a role model in terms of social-emotional intelligence. What is emotional intelligence? It's this new term, like, do you think you have more IQ or EQ? So EQ is your emotional intelligence, like your emotional quotient. Daniel Coleman defines emotional intelligence as the ability to identify and manage one's own emotions as well as the emotions of others. So that means you know and understand yourself, but you not only understand yourself, but how you as an individual and how your emotions relate to someone else. So if you're totally self-aware, you understand how you are in crowds, let's say, but then you walk into a party and walk up to someone you have nothing to do with before you say hello to your best friend who you walk straight past, that would be a little lacking in emotional intelligence because you wouldn't understand that blowing off your friends would probably hurt their feelings, and going up to someone who barely knows you probably is not nearly as important. So I would say that Chana models emotional intelligence. What does that mean? I think we can look further into the sources and see how, rather than being chutzpahdik, Chana was coming from a place of really knowing herself and knowing her place in relation to Hashem. If we look in the Psikta Rabbati, which is a midrash, in source number 4, Vatidur Neder Vatomer Hashem Tzvakot. So again, it's picking up on the same words, Hashem Tzvakot. Mahu Hashem Tzvakot, what does this mean? Amar Rabbi Yehuda Bar Simon, Amra Chana Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Chana said to Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam, Yesh Tzava Lemala V'yesh Tzava Lemata. Hashem, you know this, there are two armies. There's one in Shemayim and there is one down on earth. Hatzava Shel Mala Einam Ochlim, V'lo Shotim, V'lo Parim, V'lo Ravim, V'lo Mitim, Elo Chayim Le'olam. So what distinguishes the upper army from the lower army? The upper army, which is another word for the angels, is that they don't live, they don't die, they don't eat, they don't drink, they just exist forever in whatever form existence they exist in. V'atzava shelamata ochlim v'shotim v'parim v'ravim. The army that's below, that's down on earth, the human beings, they eat and they drink and they procreate and they die. And therefore, I don't know which army I belong to. Im mishal mala, if I'm one of the army above, o mishal lamata, or if I'm one below. Im mitzava shal mala ani, if I'm one of the angels, lo ayah, lo chala, velo shati, lo molida, velo mita, then I would understand why I don't give birth, because I also don't eat, and I would also not drink, and I would also not be alive, and I will also never die. El chayel olam, rather I would exist forever. Kashem shehem chayim olam, just like they do. V'imitzava shel matani, but if I am from those below, if I'm a human being, ayochalet, I eat, vishati, and I drink, umolida, therefore I should have children. V'mita, and eventually I know I will die. K'shem shehem ochlim v'shotim v'parim v'ravim. Just like people below are supposed to eat, and they're supposed to drink, and they are supposed to procreate, and they eventually know that they will die. Zehu Hashem Tzvakot. So this is how Chana was addressing Hashem, as Hashem Tzvakot. So I think it's very interesting, if we think about this source. Chana is making it as if she has no worth without having children. Because she's saying, if I'm not having children in this world, I probably don't belong in this world, because why eat and drink and live and die and do anything? Because I'm not fulfilling all of my responsibilities. However, this seems odd because both we know, and Chana definitely knew, that there are many other functions to a human being. She's been alive for this long without having children. And she also sees so many role models, even in, we don't know every member of her family history, but even the Jewish family history, she has seen so many incredible role models that whether they ended up having children, did not end up having children, they served other purposes in the world. So it seems quite strange that Chana would make it out to be that she is worthless without having children. If we look in the following Gemara, we're going to further this point. Amra lefanav, Ribono shel Olam. Chana said before Hashem, Kol ma she'barata be'isha, lo barata davar achad betela. When you created a human being, you didn't create them with anything useless, with anything extra. Einayim lir'ot, you made them with eyes to see. Ve'aznayim lishmoa, and ears to listen. Chotem lahariach, you gave them a nose to smell. Pe ledaber, a mouth to speak. Yadayim la'asot b'hem malacha, hands to work with. Raglayim la'halach b'hen, legs to walk with, dadayim lahanik bahan, and breasts to nurse. Dadayim halalu shenatata li libi lama, why did you give me breasts if I don't have to nurse? Tain li ben veinik bahan, give me something and then I will see the purpose. Again, Chana is making it, again, still chutzpahdik. She's making it like she really has no worth, and it's just not possible that she really thought that. Yes, it's possible that she's been in this struggle, and it is so difficult, and lo aleinu, we shouldn't know from the inability to have children. But it is definitely difficult, and there is a place of defeat. But to speak with such certainty and saying, I don't even know if I'm a human being if I don't have children, it can't be that she actually believed that. So what I would like to say is that this is step one of her emotional intelligence, that you have to know yourself. And Chana knew herself, and she knew her strengths, and she knew her weaknesses, and she knew that she was not complete without having children. She does not make any statement saying that general people are incomplete. She relates it to herself. She says, I don't know where I belong, or this that you gave me, I don't see its worth. She never makes a general statement of women without children or these parts without any use for anyone. She's talking on a very personal level, which means she has a very deep level of self-awareness. And she said, I know myself, and without having children, my potential is not being optimized. So I think that's the first step in emotional intelligence, is being able to say, however challenging however hard it is, to really look inside yourself and be honest and say, like, who am I and what are my strengths and what are my weaknesses and how can I best use these strengths and weaknesses? That's the first step in really being able to have a relationship with others, is really knowing yourself. And Chana had that. And she's turning to Hashem and she's saying, you've given me this ability to be introspective and to realize my strengths. And now I am coming back to you and saying, I know that my potential is not being optimized in my current state. And that's why I feel it must change. So the first step that I think Chana is demonstrating in her emotional intelligence in this conversation with Hashem is her deep knowledge of herself. So what is the other component? Because we said emotional intelligence is not just knowledge of yourself, but it's how you relate as yourself to other people. If you look in the Gemara in source number 6 in Masechet Megillah, it says, Sheva Nevi'o Mihin, Sarah, Miriam, Dvorah, Chana, Abigail, Chulda, Esther. And obviously you could give many shiurim on each of these women, but the focus for us is Chana. That Chana was a Nevi'ah. So we could say, like, oh, Chana cheated. Like, she knew she was going to have kids. But that really is true, that Chana knew the deepest level of connection with Hashem. That speaking to Hashem, in whatever way the Nevi'im did it, I can tell you is much more direct than my communication with Hashem. That whether it was a dream or however the different Mefarshim understand it, she had a very close relationship with Hashem. And she understood that she was able to communicate with Hashem in a certain way. Also, because she was a Nevi'ah, not only did she know this level of communication with Hashem, but she probably knew, this is my assumption, that she was going to have a child. We don't know that they knew everything in their lives through Nevi'ah, but I would venture to say that if she is willing to come to Hashem with this level of confidence, that there is definitely a chance that she knew she was going to have a child. There is a concept that Rav Soloveitchik speaks about, that if you know you have been promised something, you have the right to demand it, even from Hashem. So, for example, he relates it in terms of the Geula, that we have been promised that Hashem will send the Geula to us, and therefore we should approach davening for Geula in a way of sort of demanding it from Hashem, that to show that you really care about something that you know you've been promised, you do have the right to demand it from Hashem. So therefore, if Chana knew that she was going to have a child, that she had been promised it by Hashem, and she knew it was just a matter of waiting or figuring out what she had to do to merit having a child, she was going to pull out all the stops. And between knowing that and that she had worked her way up, it said that she was a regular in the Beis HaMikdash. This was not the first time she had been there. Another one of the Gemaras that I did not bring says that she was Tadir Lihiot Bamikdash. She was a regular. She was always there. She had worked on this connection with Hashem. She had really built it up. So between knowing that she had been promised a child and knowing that she had this relationship with Hashem and this closeness, she was able to say, I know my relationship with Hashem and I know he's promised this to me, so I have a right to demand this from Hashem.
How do we explain Ailey's reaction to her?
I think her method...
If she was a regular, he would know who she was and know her sincerity and not accuse her of being drunk.
Right. I think that most women who came to the Beis HaMikdash to daven regularly did not daven in front of the Kohen Gadol. I think there's like the Ezras Nashim, they daven there. Like, I think there was a more regular way, and I still think that along with the audacity of a lot of the sources we've seen, I don't think it was a regular thing to just go before the Kohen Gadol and daven in the way.
She didn't know he was there. The way I read it, she didn't know he was there. She was so immersed in her own tefillah, he saw her, and from what he observed, wrongly, but there was
maybe she didn't daven
frivolousness.
Maybe she never davened to that level before.
That
I'm just throwing.
No, I can accept it, actually, because there was a lot of frivolous stuff going on. It was a chag and that kind of stuff went on in those days in Shiloh from what I've read, and he just assumed this was another drunk woman in the wrong place. That's the way I understood it, always.
Right. I think that's definitely a good question. I think the way I always understood it is that she did kind of go into a place that people did not regularly daven. I guess it's funny, it's how each person like reads the psukim and pictures it. I always pictured it was kind of like crazy outside, and somehow she got into like barged in and like got into the place she was not meant to be.
Yes. I've seen, you know, the excavations, and I remember when I saw it, I said, oh goodness, now it makes sense.
Yes.
Just the way it you see the stones, and I could visualize it kind of better.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah, so I think either way that you understand it, it definitely could be true that she was just davening in a new way, that even if she always came, I would imagine not every Wednesday morning Shacharis was quite to this level, because that would get to be a little much. But I'm not sure. I think you would either have to say that she was in a different place, or Ailey saw her in a different way, or she was davening.
Because it says that every year, or whatever, all Shalosh Regalim, that Elkanah would go up.
Right.
To Shiloh. So we're told that it is a chag. It's not just a stam.
Yes. But the Gemara does emphasize that she was Tadir Lihiot Bamikdash, that even if her family went up Shalosh Regalim, maybe for a woman being in the Beis HaMikdash at those three times was considered to be Tadir. Or maybe she also made the occasional passing by trip to the Mikdash without her family. Who knows? That would be interesting for a woman at that time, but
yeah.
You never know. Maybe it was that she made a point to be there when her family was there. I'm not sure, but I think it does call into question thinking that it was seen that she was a regular there.
Mm-hmm.
So how was this time different? For sure, it's interesting to think about. And the last source that I think connects back to the fact that she thought that she had a right to the child for whatever reason. In source number 7, the Radak says, "Ubidrash amru la lachana, lama at mevakesha zera anashim chachamim zera anashim neviim, amra lahem sheyehira oilata tola Hashem, vizehu vinatativ la Hashem." So they said, "Chana, beggars can't be choosers. If you're asking for children and you're going out of all this way, all I need is a child. Why bother asking for Anashim Chachamim, for smart children, one that'll be worthy to be a Navi? Like, that's a lot to ask for. Like, let's worry about getting you a child first, let alone he should be worthy of being a Navi." And Chana answers them and says, "No, my goal in having this child is to give this child to Hashem." That she had a very clear sense of purpose, and it fit in with her relationship with Hashem. She said, "I am at this close level with Hashem. I know that my purpose in having this child is not for myself, which furthers our could further our understanding that she had been promised this child through Nebuah and therefore knew it would be a special child. She says, I am having this child for the sole purpose of giving it over to Hashem. So I'm not going to stop at just asking for a child, because this is going to be a child that is dedicated to Hashem. And therefore, I have to ask for a chacham, a navon, someone who is worthy of being a navi, because my purpose in this is not personal. It's for Hashem. So however we relate that back to the earlier sources of her saying she feels incomplete, I would have to say that she was on such a high level that her feeling of incompleteness was on a higher level than just wanting the physical desire, the personal, emotional desire of having a child, that she knew herself and she had to have this child in order to give it over to Hashem. Yeah, was there a question?
Shmuel came from Korah, and he was on the, Shmuel was on the level of Moshe and Aaron, so I don't know if it was on the maternal or paternal side, but did Korah know that he would have this great descendant? And did Hannah have some sense that she was a woman, that she was destined to have a very special child?
I think
not just a Talmid Chacham, but a superlative, accomplished person.
I can't say for sure, but I would say definitely based on this Radak and just the sense that she says right away, there's all sorts of questions about if she was able to give him over as a Nazir and if that was binding, if he was a Nazir because they said they would never cut his hair. I think it's apparent from her request that she thinks he will be on a higher level because she's already pledging from the moment she asks for the child that she's going to hand this child over to Hashem, that she knows. I was listening to Shir by someone who was talking about also this idea of Chana giving over her child to Hashem. And he said, like, this wasn't when you send your kid to Israel for a year. Like, she very possibly was never seeing her son again. It happens to be we said she was Tadir in the Mikdash. She might have hoped, but who knows? He might have, once he's not her child, he's not connected to her in that way. She really doesn't have control over that, that she's going to be able to, like, come see him. So I think just based on her request, she either knew he was going to be something special and therefore was pledging him, or knew that through pledging him to Hashem and having him be this child for Hashem, that he would end up being something great. I think it could go either way. But I would venture to say that she did know he would be something special, and that's why she continued to demand a child at this level. So we can say that these were the two components of Hannah's emotional intelligence, that she knew herself, she knew what she needed, she knew her qualities, her strengths, and what she needed to fulfill her potential, and she also knew how she related to Hashem. She knew that she had built up this regular, close, deep relationship with Hashem, and she knew what her motivations were. She knew that she wanted to dedicate her life and her child and everything to Hashem. So I think another great example of this idea is something, again, hard to relate to. I want everyone to take themselves as much as you can and try to think of the first Yom Kippur after the Holocaust. In a DP camp, I was reading one of the Holocaust websites was talking about how the first Yom Kippur after the Holocaust, we all think about fasting for Yom Kippur. It said, don't worry, that was the easy part. Fasting was what they were used to. It was every person had to really stop before that Yom Kippur and think about how they were now going to relate to God. And that was a very pivotal moment for a lot of people, that this was the first time they really got to stop and think and really try to imagine how they see their connection with God continuing forward after such a tragedy. So there's a few famous stories of the Kleisenberger Rebbe from that first Yom Kippur. If anyone's ever heard the extremely moving story of the line of girls that lined up after outside the Kleisenberger Rebbe's door for brachot on that Arab Yom Kippur, I'm not a crier, and that can definitely make you cry. So one thing that really stood out to me was the drasha that the Kleisenberger Rebbe gave on that first Yom Kippur and Shul. And trust me, this was not when the rabbi gets up and everyone's looking at their watch. People were waiting to hear what the Kleisenberger Rebbe was going to say. And so the Rebbe stands up, himself extremely weak and tired from the war. The Kleisenberger Rebbe had been through Auschwitz. He lost 11 children in the Holocaust. He lost 10 in Auschwitz, and the 11th died at the end of the war. He himself was definitely extremely worn out. This Yom Kippur came right before his meeting with President Eisenhower. And he gets up on the night of Yom Kippur. And this was after a day, it's told that he took a day of meditation, of really trying to think and comprehend how he was going to go into this Yom Kippur. And he stands up and they get up to Vidoy. And the Kleisenberger Rebbe stands up out loud and he says, Ashamnu? God, did we sin? But God knew. God, were we unfaithful? Did we ever desert God? We weren't unfaithful. Gazal knew. Who was there to steal from in Auschwitz? We didn't steal. Marad knew. We rebelled. We didn't rebel. We didn't rebel against God. We didn't rebel against you, the master of the universe. We could have rebelled. He closed his sitter. He said, this Vidoy was not written for us. We didn't do these things. He says, but we are guilty of one thing. It's not written in the Machzor. He said, we're guilty of davening that it should just all be over, that we shouldn't have to wake up another morning and say Moda Ani. It was so hard to wake up all of those days. And we're guilty of that, Hashem. We're guilty of just wanting it, of losing our faith, of just wanting it all to be over and wanting to be done with all of it. So Hashem, please restore our faith and make it that we're able to never lose our faith again. You can imagine there was no talking in Shul that Yom Kippur. That the Kleisenberger Rebbe had this relationship with God, and especially in such a terrible, tragic time, to have been able to be that honest with himself and say, I am this close with God, that I can come before God and say, I didn't sin. I didn't rebel against you. I didn't steal. I didn't do any of the things that human beings are theoretically supposed to have done in a year, in this generic list of sins. But he came to God and he said, I'm sorry if I lost faith. Can you help me with that? Can you help us as a community to restore our faith? So I think this is another example, like Chana, of someone who was able to truly come before God and say, I know what I did, I know what I'm worthy of, and I know what I didn't do. And because of that, I really feel that I know what I deserve, and I'm able to ask that from you, Hashem. So how does this relate to us? Because we're not Chana, Hanaviah. We don't know things through Nevuah. We're not in the Beis HaMikdash. Nobody's learning any Hilchot Tefillah from me unless I give a shiur on it. I will not be originating it. And thank God we are not the Kleisenberger Rebbe in a DP camp following the Holocaust. We're just average people coming before Hashem for another Rosh Hashanah. So how are we supposed to take these lessons and apply them to our lives? And I think taking the idea of figuring out our spiritual, emotional intelligence is something that's really tangible to each of us. I think it means taking a few moments. It could be while you're going, if it doesn't seem like there will be any spare moments between now and the minute that Rosh Hashanah starts. I think it just takes thinking about what are my strengths? Have I used them this year? How do I relate to everything I do in my life? How have I related to this past year? Am I optimizing my potential? Am I even thinking about optimizing, like fulfilling my potential and working on things? And it's really knowing where you're at. And once you know where you think you're holding, what you have done, what you haven't done, and it's being honest, you can go through, I heard someone suggest that you should go through a list of all the of all of Vidwayan, go through Al-Khayt Shachatati. And you should start from a place of, what did I do well? So where it says, Bezilzel Horim Umorim, that I didn't respect my parents appropriately. Sit down and say, okay, how many times did I respect my parents? And it doesn't have to be a count. It's, I know that I'm great at calling my parents before Shabbos, but maybe it's that I'm not so great at respecting everything they have to say. Maybe I think I know better. Not that anyone in this room would ever think that. I think it's honestly saying to yourself, what have I done well? Because I think Chana demonstrates that well, that she knows what she's worthy of. And she says, this is what I'm lacking. So to be able to have that self-awareness and just really think about that in terms of ourselves, of what have we done well and what we have not done well. So you honestly know what you can improve with. And once you have that deep knowledge of yourself and have even taken a few moments to think about, what did I do well this past year and how do I want to change that for this upcoming year? Think about if you're in that place with Hashem to even feel that you can come and communicate about that. That Chana had to feel like she had a regular communication with Hashem. And kind of stopping and thinking about, like, do we put the energy in the rest of the year? Whether that means davening one line of one tefillah with kavana, or that means taking on saying brachot, or anything that makes you feel that you now have the right to come before Hashem and ask him for these things on Rosh Hashanah. So I think it takes knowing yourself and knowing honestly where you stand with God, because that's the beauty of Rosh Hashanah and the beauty of the tshuva process is that every year we get the chance to renew this relationship and work on it, and it's a constant growing process. So I think that my bracha for everyone this Rosh Hashanah is to really be able to work on this spiritual emotional intelligence, to be able to honestly look into yourself and say, where am I holding? And turn to God and say, I want to be in this relationship with you. I want to grow in this relationship and be able to develop this deep emotional connection with God.